Welcome to Feasting on Design. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. This week on the podcast, I'm chatting with Billy Bauman from Delicious Design League. During this episode, we dive into how Delicious Design League got started and how it has evolved over the years, teaching packaging design at the Chicago Portfolio Center, how he approaches packaging design for the food and beverage industry by combining classic and modern styles, and so much more. This episode is brought to you by Roasters Marketplace. Roasters Marketplace curates small batch specialty coffee from 29 different micro roasters around the country. You can find them at roastersmarketplace.com or on social media, and use the code FEAST for free shipping on your first order. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/feastingondesign. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Feasting on Design patron, you'll get access to exciting Feasting on Design news before anyone else, plus stickers and t-shirts. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/feastingondesign. Billy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I literally right before hopped on the call with you, finished listening to your episode of He Shoots, He Draws with my buddy Dave Clayton.
My apologies.
No, it was good. It was good. It gave me a lot of jumping off points that I can talk to you about now. So
yeah, I'll try that. I'll try not to repeat myself. If I do, just give me the high sign and I'll change it up.
Let's kind of start from the beginning of how did you get your start in design in general?
Well, I grew up in the St. Louis area.
Okay.
St. Charles, Missouri, to be specific. Mm-hmm. I was how do I put this? Emotionally stunted I was a late bloomer. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
So I wasn't really ready to go away to school. The world was too scary for me at that time. So I went to a community college that was in St. Louis, but it actually had an accredited, one of the few community colleges that had an accredited art and design program, had a really good program. So I went there for a while and then ended up getting an internship in 1998 at a local advertising agency called Zipitone. Mm-hmm. They did a lot of promotional marketing, advertising. Do you remember the whole Miller Lite campaign with Dick?
Oh, God,
the Dick campaign.
I vaguely remember it. Yeah.
So that the Dick campaign is precisely the time that I got the job at Zipitone, and Zipitone was that's what they were doing. They were doing Dick campaign. So that sort of places me in sort of the history of advertising.
Sure.
So I hated school, terrible student. Got the internship, quit school, and didn't tell them I quit school, and just got them to hire me. But after 3 months, they hired me, and then I worked there. And then they opened an office in Chicago in 2000. I convinced them to move me up to Chicago to start working there.
Gotcha.
And then in 2003, I started a band with some friends of mine, and we needed a poster for the band for the first show. So I made a poster, and at the time I was going to this website called gigposters.com.
I remember them.
Yeah, so this is before you know, Instagram or Twitter or any of these, or Dribbble or anything like that, right? Sure. So there really wasn't really great outlets to make your own mark. But Gig Posters was one of the first ones, and I saw this as an opportunity. Because I was like designing the backs of cereal boxes and things like that. It's like, okay, here's my chance. So I started doing more gig posters, and then that grew and that grew. And then my friend Jason joined me in 2006, and we decided to say, hey, let's make this gig poster thing, try to make it a real design company. And then by 2008, I was able to quit my day job. And I've been doing that ever since.
Go full time. So yeah, where did the name Delicious Design League come from?
Jesus. Yeah. First of all, I realize it's a terrible name. It's really stupid.
I've heard worse.
Yeah, I have heard worse too. Yeah. when I made my first couple posters, around the same time, my friends jokingly started calling me Delicious. Mm-hmm. Based off of, I think, the original Kings of Comedy. Like,
oh God, yeah.
If you can imagine this, it was some joke about some guy in the neighborhood named Delicious. So they're like, oh, let's just start calling Billy Delicious. And then as an inside joke, I started signing my posters as Delicious. Nobody actually called me Delicious. It was just like an inside joke.
Sure.
But then the name stuck. And then when we tried to make it a real business, we're like, well, we kind of have this name Delicious. Let's just put Design League on the back end to make it sound a little more official. You know, I come from the Stan Lee school of naming things, so I like the alliteration with the Delicious and the Design. And then I also liked big comic book nerd, so I always liked the idea of the Justice League. Mm-hmm. So I was like, a league sounds cool. It sounds like sort of like an old 1920s like sort of professionals group.
Yeah.
You know, that would meet at the Moose Lodge. So I was like, okay, that's how we came up with Delicious Design League, and we've been stuck with it ever since. Yeah.
Don't be embarrassed of it. I don't think it's a bad name. It's certainly it's certainly memorable.
Well, I appreciate that. It takes a while, like, because we sound like a bakery or something like that. You know, sure. Your name's Delicious, or you think that we just design like cupcake packaging or something like that.
Hey, know? There's money to be made in that. So
yes, yeah,
there's nothing wrong with that.
yeah.
So as you're starting up the business, it's you and your buddy Jason.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's kind of like the sales end of things, and you're the design end of things. And
yeah, he runs everything. Mm-hmm. Basically, and I'm the creative director, the head designer person.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So when that's starting up, how are you supplementing? Because it's tough to make a living off just gig posters.
Impossible. Unless there's like five or six people that can do it.
Yeah.
So we weren't a gig poster company. We were like, okay, we're going to use this gig poster thing to be a real company, quote unquote.
Right. I like the quote,
you know,
unquote.
There. A couple things, you know, like I remember when we first started the company and people would be like, oh, I wish I could start my own company. Mm-hmm. I wish I could quit my job tomorrow and start my own company, but that's not how it works. Right.
You can, it's not a good idea.
Not a good idea. So you have to, moonlight. For a couple of years, right? So that's what was happening, is I still had my day job.
Okay.
And then I would work at night and weekends to try to build a small client base to get off the ground. And then
burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm in my 20s, so it's...
Sure.
I don't have a kid or a mortgage, so that's fine. And so... lost my track of thought. So... burning candle at both ends for years. Mm-hmm. And then also I moved in with Jason and his wife, lived upstairs at their house, and our studio was in the basement, and he charged me $300 in rent.
That's pretty good, especially right? for Chicago.
Yeah. So cutting the cost of my life by a lot, right? Living really cheaply and moonlighting is, you know... maybe if you're lucky, you have like, you know, you hear stories about people that start their company because they were a partner at some place and they left and took the biggest client with them. And then now they're their own boss or something. Right.
Sure.
You hear that story rarely, but, you know, it happens. But we didn't have that set up at all. you know. Yeah. And then over the years, you know, we just kind of got lucky with having the right client at the right time that would sort of float us, right? Mm-hmm. One of our first big clients was Mozilla, which they do the Firefox.
Yeah, Firefox, yeah.
Yeah, so back in the day, they used to have all these illustrations on Firefox throughout their website, and we did all those illustrations. And that was one of our first big long-term clients. Mm-hmm. We did a bunch of illustrations all the time for them. And then... Threadless was one of our early clients.
Okay.
We would do, for a while, they were doing posters, and I was doing a lot of the color separations on all the posters. So it was like really like technical screen printing kind of stuff. Right. Gotcha. So you just have some clients like that and they can sort of get the ball rolling, you know,
sure,
financially.
When you're doing that, are you, cause you guys have a screen printing shop now too, right?
And yeah. Well, yeah. So we never really abandoned the poster thing.
Yeah.
But we thought, well, if we got all the equipment, we might as well print for other people too.
Right. That, right? That's what I was wondering, if you had the, if you had the screen printing equipment at the time, or if you were borrowing somebody else's.
No. Well, when we first started, we were screen printing out of this place called Screwball Press, which is Steve Walters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you learn more, the more and more you learn about the Chicago screen printing community, it all kind of eventually comes down to Steve Walters and Screwball Press. So we learned how to screen print there. We rent his space. And then eventually we move, when Jason got his house, we moved the screen printing shop into the basement.
Okay.
His house.
Okay. Yeah.
And then as the years go by, you buy more and more equipment. You get, you know, more and more ink, more and more screens, more and more machines, you know, so you have all this investment, but you're not using it 24/7. Mm-hmm. So now we have a full-time print shop guy and we just print for other people like 99% of the time.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a nice way to supplement some income in there too.
Well, yes and no. The problem with the biggest, what I've learned is, if you can be a web designer and all you ever do is make pixels, you know what I'm saying?
You can make a lot better money than most of
your overhead is great, right?
Yeah.
We have to have a huge space for paper and ink and paper cutters and machines and delivery and shipping, and there's mistakes, and it's like any little mistake is going to cost you thousands of dollars, and now you just lost, now you didn't make any money on that thing you did. It's a racket. It's a tough racket, screen printing. So we've definitely had moments where like, let's just be a design company and forget about the screen printing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't yet, because we still love the medium. And we still love being able to offer that to our clients as well, you know? So we still got it.
Gotcha.
Like a barnacle.
As you're growing and kind of diversifying and getting into, you know, branding and websites and things like that, you know, because if you started in 98, web was still not a huge thing. It was just kind of starting and definitely wasn't like it is now.
Yeah, so, pre-2000, so like 99 and 98, if you had a small web design company, you were getting bought.
Yeah.
You had a very good chance of getting bought. So I remember the Zipitone, the place I worked for, did buy a place locally, right? I'm actually designing a website right now, and I hate it. I hate doing web stuff. I don't like...
I'm with you. I can't do it. I mean, I can do it. I just don't like to do it.
I always like to say it's like laying out a textbook in Photoshop.
Yes. I think that's what part of my problem is with it is.
Yeah.
Like, because, I mean, my background's in marketing design and branding and stuff. So I'm fine using InDesign and laying stuff out there. I can do that all day. But if you make me lay out something in Photoshop or... you know, Adobe XD or Figma or whatever just like, just shoot me.
I don't find it interesting.
Yeah.
At all. Yeah. And, but that's sort of a side complaint, I guess.
that's the reality of the world is you have to learn how to do it to make a living nowadays. It's
unavoidable. But then in 2000, right? But then in 2000, we had the dot-com crash, right? Because everybody overinvested, right? And then it crashed. And so that was it. So I ended up getting laid off around 2002, I think.
Okay.
As a result of that, you know. I'll be heading into my third recession now in my career, I guess.
Lucky right you. Now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. I know the feeling.
Yeah. Yay.
So as we were saying, as things start to grow, how are you teaching yourself these new skills while running a business at the same time?
Well, I've hired people that are better at designing websites than me. So that helps a lot.
Yeah.
Or like to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's really important to hire people that have different skill sets than you.
Mm-hmm.
That compliment you, that you butt heads with creatively, you know, which is actually good. For me, it's always the challenge is always just how to get better at my craft.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, how do I draw a better circle? You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, you know, how do I make a better logo? How do I make a better this? How do I make a better that? It's very technical. Mm-hmm. aspect for me. So I honestly don't spend that much time learning new stuff as I should be.
Okay.
Like, I've dabbled in After Effects and I know I should do that. And I've dabbled in web design. I know I need to do that. I'm becoming a dinosaur, but I'm still obsessed with drawing the perfect circle. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
So don't do what I've done. You know, it's probably better to learn all the new tools and, but I'm really good with I'm good at Illustrator.
I'm the same way.
Yeah.
And give me Illustrator and InDesign, I can do just about anything.
Yeah. I don't touch InDesign. I'm just more of I do touch it when I have to. I'm more of a Illustrator Photoshop guy.
Just sure.
School. Yeah. Yeah.
So, As you're growing and hiring people, since we touched on that, what do you start looking for in people that you're wanting to hire? You mentioned the butting heads creatively.
Yeah.
But
I mean, to a certain level, that's good. To a certain level, that's bad. But
yeah. Well, you don't want to work with an asshole.
No, you definitely don't want to work with an asshole. And plenty of my employees think I'm the asshole.
That's the other side of the coin. Yeah.
I look for two things, three things, 10 things, but the two things I'm looking for are really, I want to see passion, right? I don't need to, especially if you're like a young guy coming or girl coming out of school. I want to see that. I got to see that passion for the work. Like, if in your portfolio, all I see is the same 10 school assignments that everybody had to put in their portfolio from your school, right?
Swiss design.
Yeah. Or just like the same assignments that everybody had.
Yeah.
And that's in your, and there's, you didn't do anything outside of school.
Sure.
If there's nothing outside of school in your portfolio, that tells me that you maybe aren't as passionate as someone that we need, especially when you're working in a small company that only has a handful of employees. We got to have people that are really, really want to do it, that are really into it. And so I need to see that passion. I also look for people. So we're small, but one of our main selling points is that we also do illustration.
Yeah.
And so a lot of our clients come to us with not big budgets. Like everybody. And so we need to be able to create content for them, right? Whatever that might be. And so we can use illustration to create whatever that thing is that needs to fill the page for people to look at, instead of just going to a stock photography site or something like that.
Sure.
So I a lot of times look for strong illustration skills first, honestly.
Okay.
Because I was like, well, I can always... It's much harder for me to teach a good designer how to be a good illustrator. It's much easier for me to teach a good illustrator how to be a good designer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In my philosophy, like if you have like the classical background, like if you took figure drawing class and drawing class and you know how to draw in perspective and like spatial relationship is and sort of basic color theory kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then I can teach you how to make a logo. I can teach you what kerning is. Right. But if somebody only knows how to like do Swiss design and kerning and bullshit, right?
Yeah.
And grid systems, it's almost impossible for me to teach them all the other classical elements of illustration and aesthetics, basically. Right.
I can see that. I'm a mediocre illustrator and mediocre designer. So I, you know.
Yeah. I think we all sort of think that about ourselves. Yeah. I would describe myself in the same way, you know. But that's sort of how I like to look at it. Like, if you can draw, and I understand that that's because of the kind of work that our clients are coming to us with. Also, that's the kind of designer that I am, right? I got my first internship because I could draw, and my design skills were not that great, and so they saw something in that, I guess. So I'm sort of prejudiced, I guess, in that sense,
sure,
about who I'm looking for. So if you got the passion and you can draw a little bit, then that's kind of what I'm looking for. Of course, it all depends on the level that you are at.
Right. Right.
If you're more mid-level, senior level, then I'm looking for what Jason and I call a motherfucker. Can I cuss on this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Like we're looking for a motherfucker, right? We're looking for a straight killer, right?
Sure.
Someone that you can give a project to, you don't have to babysit them, and they come up with they're self-sufficient. You know, they can feed themselves and they can figure stuff out and it can do amazing work. You know, those are unicorns, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We've had a handful of them. So I know they exist, right? The hard part about a unicorn is keeping them.
Yeah. I was about to say, that's tracked. The hard part is keeping them.
Yes.
And a lot of times keeping them on track.
Well, it depends. Like we've had some just amazing people that are like that. You know, the way better, way harder workers than I am, you know, we've gotten really lucky with a lot of designers, but yes, it's holding on to them, getting them from, wanting to go and do their own thing. Not that I want to stop them. I don't want to stop anybody from fulfilling their dreams or anything like that.
Sure.
Or they need to go someplace where they can just make more money. That happens a lot of times too. You know, we can afford people some freedom and some like cool stuff to work on, but we can't exactly pay as much as a big agency.
Yeah. You can't pay landlord rates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I wish I could. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know what the rates are, but you could
really be lazy because their CCOs, all they do is just have people that manage people for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's another one of my big issues is that I see myself as a player coach, right? Like I'm still designing every day as well as managing. So I need people to be able to self-manage to some extent because I'm still designing. I'm not going to give that up, you know?
Yeah.
Also that's, I'm not a great manager. I'm a much better designer than I am a manager.
I can relate to that. I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to teaching, because before we hopped on, we were talking about your teaching and all that. What is kind of your teaching ethos and how do you approach that?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if I've ever had an ethos about teaching, but so I teach at a place called the Chicago Portfolio School. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
So, we get a lot of people that have a degree in biology or psychology or just marketing, right? Like we get people that work at an ad agency on the account side. They're like, oh, that looks way more fun over there on that side of the aisle. I want to do that. So those are the kind of people that we get. And so my class, I specifically teach package design in my class. I've been doing that for maybe 8 years now. And so since I work at the Chicago Portfolio School, my class, I really have like two sort of goals for my students. One, I have to do what the label of the school is. I need to get you something for your portfolio, right?
Sure.
So that's one of our focuses. But in package design, it's so technical, right? From dye lines to all the different kinds of folds to bleed, spot colors to you name it, right?
Yeah.
It's such a technical part of design that I really try to prepare them for that aspect of it. Like when you get in the real world and you have to talk to a printer and you got to use their language, you need to know what they're talking about, or you have a client that comes to you and be like, I need you to lay this, here's a die line, do your design on it. I need you to know how to do it. Right.
Yeah.
Or if you have to edit that die line, I'm going to teach you how to do that. So I try to, one, get them something for the portfolio, two, prepare them for the real world. And then three, since I'm teaching, I have a wide range of students. Mm-hmm. A lot of my class, I just focus on like my sort of personal philosophies of design, like just really teaching the nuts and bolts of design, of like, you know, everything from, you know, just really technical, like, why does this look good and why doesn't this look good?
Sure.
And how do you get your thing to look good? What's the thought process behind it? What's the whole methodology? So it's package design class, but also just graphic design class.
Gotcha. Well, that's what I was wondering, is because a lot of those schools do kind of do that, where they've got somebody who has absolutely no background in the industry who comes in and has decided that they want to be a designer or art director or whatever. Cause
yeah, one of our old employees, he was a student there and he got an internship with us. He had a degree in biology.
Okay.
He ended up being one of the best designers we've ever had. Mm-hmm. He just, I don't know why he, you know, a lot of people get a degree in something credible because that's what they think they're supposed to do with their life.
Sure.
And then they realize, oh, there's this thing called design. I could do this with my life, you know? I don't know. It catches them by surprise or something.
Yeah.
So even if they don't have that background, I've seen it work, surprisingly, even to myself. Yeah.
Well, I think you can teach anybody to be a designer. But there is... You do have to have a certain level of talent to progress beyond what you've just learned.
Yeah. Curiosity, talent. There's, I mean, there's, call it whatever you want, but like you can watch all the film study you want on how to dunk a basketball. Right. And you can I could practice, you know, 3 hours a day for 3 months. And I don't think I'm only 5'7". I don't think I'm ever going to be able to dunk a basketball. You know what I'm saying?
Probably not.
So like everybody can get to a certain level, but some people just have something that they can go to the next levels with. You know?
Yeah. And I think that's what I was getting at with that.
Yeah.
To be able to get to that next level, you've got to have talent. You've also got to have passion. And that's what you
mentioned. Passion is the biggest thing. And and I tell my students, I can't teach you passion, right? Yeah. I can point you, like, look how cool this is, guys. Look how cool this is. Look how cool this is, right?
Yeah.
But if they don't get excited about it, I can't. There's literally nothing I can do beyond that. Which is frustrating for me as a teacher, because it's like, you know, it's like having your favorite band and you're trying to, you know, share it with your friends and nobody likes them except you. You know what I mean? So like, you're like, why aren't you as passionate about this as I am? You know, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think the technical abilities and the talent come into play when your passion wanes, because we all hit those burnout points. And you've got to have something to fall back on, because I'm sure you've had client projects where you're like, you take it because it's going to pay the bills more it's going to be. And you're not passionate about it, but that's when you rely on your training and technical skills and the talent that you have to take something from a very not exciting client and turn it into something that really works and speaks to their market.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, all the cool designers that you know out there, not you, whoever's listening, right?
Yeah.
Like all these cool designers, they all, almost all, have stuff in their billing that doesn't make it to their portfolio.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's curated.
Everybody. You look at these other people and you're like, I want to do work like Tad Carpenter. I tell you right now, Tad Carpenter's got some BS projects that he's dealing with every day that mm-hmm. He's not sharing with anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he's not showing you Yeah Burger every day.
Right. And it's the same with us, right? We do a lot of cool stuff and we have a lot of fun. We've got a lot of great clients. Mm-hmm. But a lot of graphic design is digging a ditch.
Yeah.
You know, without the sweating.
Yeah.
Like you're just, it's like, okay, time to make the donuts, you know. Let me move these pixels around until I got it.
Well, that's why I got good at marketing design is because nobody wants to do it. Nobody really likes marketing design, but it pays the bills really well.
Yeah.
But that's not the stuff I show off in my portfolio. I mean, I have a little bit in it there where there's some pieces that it's like, no, this really nails the mark of kind of stuff that I like to do. So yes. I'll put that in there. But for the most part, the pamphlets and the brochures are not the exciting thing that I'm showing off every day, but they're the ones that are keeping the lights on. Roasters Marketplace curates small batch specialty coffee from 29 different micro roasters from around the country. Not only can you shop an amazing selection of single origin beans, but you can find out the story behind each craftsman. They even have their own podcast, so you can meet your coffee roaster. RoastersMarketplace.com is not your typical coffee website. You can shop by origin, roast level, processing method, and even flavor notes. Whether you're looking for a delicious light roast with hints of blueberry and almonds, or a bold dark roast with notes of dark chocolate and molasses, Roasters Marketplace can help you on the quest to find the perfect cup. Become a Roasters Marketplace member and get free shipping on every order, including a great selection of subscriptions. You can find them at RoastersMarketplace.com or on social media. Use the code FEAST for free shipping on your first order. They're constantly running incredible specials on bundle packs of design assets and fonts for up to 99% off the regular price. Their products are some of the best out there. And their customer service is top notch. If you head over to feastingondesign.com/designcuts, you can check out their latest bundle pack at an exceptional discount and help support the podcast. If you haven't tried Webflow yet, when building a website, what are you waiting for? Webflow is a great no-code alternative to WordPress. You get so much more control over the design of the site compared to your traditional templated no-code sites like Squarespace or Wix. Give it a shot on your next site. Visit feastingondesign.com/webflow to sign up for your free trial today.
Yeah, what's been your strategy for getting and maintaining or getting new clientele?
Panic and begging work the best.
Yeah, but do you wait for the phone to ring?
I've been bad about that. I need to be better about networking and getting out there and picking up the phone and calling people. But I when it comes to making a cold call to somebody, I break out in a flop sweat and I don't know what to do.
How often can that work? We wait for the phone to ring too. We've been in business for, I don't know, 14 years.
Yeah.
We wait for the phone to ring as well. I'm sure there are some really great salespeople and some really good like client getter people.
Yeah.
But that's not me or Jason, you know? Yeah. And so honestly, I've been doing this 14 years. It's still a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. You know, the only advice, which is horrible advice, is put your best work out there and cross your fingers.
Yeah. And that's where that's the one thing that I suck at is like, I am terrible at self-promotion. Like I will, cause I feel, I don't know. I feel inauthentic when I'm like pimping myself out on Instagram, putting stuff out and I will drag my feet putting it together, but I know it's what I need to be doing.
You know, that's the great thing about having a name for your company as opposed to this isn't Billy Bauman Design Company,
right?
Is I feel less shame because I can use we instead of I in all the posts. So then it feels, I feel like I'm just more, I'm not pimping me, I'm pimping the team.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's,
and that actually helps.
Yeah. Cause so my wife is my business partner and we're both designers. And I think your wife's a designer as well, isn't she?
Yeah, she's more illustrator designer.
Okay,
illustrator first designer. Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a designer before illustrator. Way more designer before illustrator. Yeah, yeah. So is my wife. My wife's a great painter, but when it comes to illustration, she doesn't like that stuff. I do. I'm just, it's the imposter syndrome thing that everybody gets with stuff. Shit. It's I get in my own head about it.
Absolutely. I think it's that, I wonder, you know, in my 20s, I was, you know, you're young and dumb, right?
Yes.
And it's like, you're so stupid. You don't know you're not supposed to be doing these things. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like in your 20s is a great time to start a business
because
you don't have that. First of all, you don't have any of the expenses that you might have when you're in your 40s, like I am.
Yeah,
but like, but you don't, you're so dumb. You don't know that, you don't know how much you suck. So you just do, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Like I didn't have imposter syndrome in my 20s because.
No, I didn't either.
I was too stupid to know that I should be, because it's too stupid to know that I was an imposter.
Yeah.
You know?
I didn't have any. I will say in my 20s, though, I also didn't have, like some people I know in their 20s think they're the next Saul Bass or Milton Glaser or somebody like that. Yeah. I never had that aspiration. I just wanted to be good enough to get a job or earn a living, make a little extra money freelancing, stuff like that. It wasn't until I hit my 40s and really this past year where it was like a tipping point where I was like, I've been at this job for almost 8 years. I hate it here. It sucks.
Yeah.
We've got enough business where we can make this. I picked the worst time to do it. And we didn't officially go full time until October of this last year.
Oh, really?
So yeah. I picked I had the worst timing, which is the story of my life.
Yeah. But
in my 40s, I had enough confidence. Like I can do this. I've got enough contacts. I've got enough business that I can keep myself afloat. Plus we've got enough savings. We can make this last for a good 6 months without any clients. And until December, we had plenty of money coming in. We had good clients. And then January hit and it started slowing down. And then,
well, you know, the beginning of the year, even without COVID and stuff, the
beginning of the year is always slow.
It's always slow. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was fine with that. I knew it was going to be. And then the pandemic hits and that's when I shit my pants and was like, oh God, what am I going to do?
We thankfully, knock on wood, have had some clients really scale back, but some of our clients, they haven't been affected. And that's been a huge relief for us. So we have some packaged food clients. Mm-hmm. And so the grocery stores are still open. People are still buying food.
Yeah, food's not going away. Video games aren't going away.
And so one of our other big clients is a video game client.
Oh, okay.
We've been doing a lot of Fortnite work.
Oh, so Epic Games. Yeah.
Epic Games. And so we still do work for them every month. And that's been great. That's been awesome for us. Thankfully.
Yeah, that's always nice to have those retainer clients. As we had just gotten to the point where we were signing retainer clients. Literally had signed an agreement with a retainer client, and then the economy just went to crap. And they were, they just called us and they're like, "Look, we don't want to break the contract, but there's no way we can pay it." And I don't want to be the bad, you know, I'm not going to be the bad guy and lose any business that I can get from them by saying, no, you agreed to this.
And what are you going to do? Are you going to hire a lawyer and
I mean,
pay him twice as much as what the invoice was?
Yeah, exactly. And then I was like, no, I completely understand. Just, you know, keep us in mind when things get better and we'll keep in touch.
One of our best long-term clients is, and I'm not going to say who it is because it's not official yet, but they're probably going out of business. And we've had them for probably 10 years now. And it's devastating, you know, just because they're friends of ours, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a bummer.
Yeah.
That's a big bummer. Who knows what'll happen in the next 6 months?
Hopefully some good news.
I mean, they say hurricane season's coming up soon. It's supposed to be a bad one. So
yeah,
we got that to look forward to.
I'm aware. I live on the Gulf Coast. We've already had our first tropical storm. And we're only 2 weeks into the season.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I am well aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, we started our company, we went full time in 2008.
Yeah, right? so the economy crashed.
That was right when the economy crashed too, right?
Yeah.
But I was also, we were living very cheaply, so we were able to sort of get by, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, a lot of the clients that you're doing package design for is in the food business and all. And since this podcast is called Feasting on Design, let's dive into that a little bit. That's an interesting realm to work in because it's, you can be very creative, but you've also got to be very technical at the same time. How are you guys finding the balance on that?
The package design is one of my favorite types of design.
Obviously, you teach about it.
Well, I kind of just stumbled into that. But I love it because I don't know. My dad was an engineer, so I like all that.
So is mine.
Yeah. So I really enjoy the technical aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we all know that designing with rules is more interesting, right?
Like, yes. If somebody gives me blue sky, I freeze up and I'm like, I don't know what the hell to do. Give me some restrictions.
And then, you know, so we started the company doing screen printed gig posters. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about the screen printed gig poster, it is several things. But one of the things was that you could really really dive in and put a lot of detail into something and make it really cool. So you have this technical aspect and limitations of package design, and then you can really needle into it.
Yeah.
Right. You can really fine tune the design in it. Mm-hmm. So I love that aspect of it. And then, you know, I don't love the regulatory and all doing all that stuff, but what I try to tell my students is like all those little bits of copy that you have to find a place for in on your package, that is actually opportunity to design, right? Yeah. You could just put it on a line at the bottom of your package, or you can design around it, you know, like, I don't know if you know the designer Josh Emmerich from Emmerich.
Yeah, Studio. I've had him on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
He's one of the first package designers that I show my students, you know? Yeah. Because he, fantastic illustrator, great typographer, but he always has interesting ways of creating that, designing the space for all the little nuggets of information that you have to put on something. He uses grids a lot for this.
Yeah, I think he's one of the first people I saw use the UPC code, but make it in a weird shape.
Oh, okay.
Because you're still getting all the information. Yes. You just need a little sliver of those lines for it to work.
Yes, you do. And sometimes you work with printers, not sometimes, all the times.
Yeah.
And you're like, I want it to look like this on purpose. And they're like, no, the barcode's got to be black on white. I'm like, no, it has to be basically just dark.
Yeah.
On a lighter color background, it'll be fine. And like you get into these technical battles. And then, you're sort of, and then the client's like, oh, the printer told us this. I'm like, ah, fuck the printer. Like, no, you don't have to do it like that. I swear to God, we could do it like this and it'll be really cool. I'm just dealing
with it. It's just got to have enough contrast for the laser to read it.
Yes. I was just had this battle like 2 weeks ago with the printer for one of our clients is in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And the it was going to be CMYK printing, basic box, right?
Sure.
And I was like, you know, guys, if we did a matte finish with a spot varnish on this, that's going to elevate the package. That's really going to help it on shelf because mm-hmm. it's looking low rent right now, right? And they're like, no, we can't do it. We can't do it. And then the printer in Thailand says, oh, if you guys want to use 3 spot colors on this plus the CMYK, we can do that. And I was like, amazing. Let's make one of the spot colors the varnish, right? And my client's like, no, they said we can't. They're like, no, they said spot color. I'm like, no, but a spot color can be any color. It can also be a varnish. So I'm having this. I ended up losing that fight because they just couldn't get over the idea that the varnish wasn't actually a color. And I'm like, okay, fine. Like making the tan background of our package a spot color is not going that. If that was CMYK, that would be completely fine. Nobody ever would notice, right? Yeah. But if there's a varnish on this, that's going to make all the difference in the world.
Yeah, that makes something stand out.
That's one of the – that was my frustration with package design last week. I really went on a tangent there. But
well, we were talking about the technical versus creativity and how you can balance that.
Yeah, and that's the technical that we're talking about there. But then also package design – I tell my students it's one of the most obvious kinds of design.
Right? Yeah.
It's like designing little billboards because you're walking down the grocery aisle and package design could be anything. You're walking in the sports supply store, right? Mm-hmm. Looking for goggles or something, whatever it is. And you have to be able to communicate to someone who is this for? Is it organic? Is it all natural? Is it junk food? Is it... Mm-hmm. Is it savory? Is it sweet? You know what I mean? Like, and you have to be able to use design cliches basically to communicate that in 2 seconds, right?
Yeah.
Not only do you have to tell them what the brand and the product and the flavor, you got to tell them who it's for, right? Mm. Is this for a crunchy person that wears Birkenstocks? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So in that sense, you don't have to be insanely clever. You have to be almost insanely obvious with your design choices. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, guys, we're not going to reinvent what organic food means here. We can push it a little bit left or right, but there's a design language that has been developed for what that is organically. It evolved that we need to play in that sandbox because we need Joe Schmo consumer to know right away what this is and who it's for. So I like that aspect of it. Like
I view that as the constraints that you have to work with of people automatically recognize like, I just blanked on it. Okay. So Hormel is low rent lunch meat for the most part, but then they came out with their natural lines and they put it in those chipboard boxes.
Yep.
And they used a different coloring and they used a die cut out to look at things and it's got an emboss on it. So it made it look better than what Hormel really is. And it changed how their lunch meats took off and more people bought them. More people were buying. Yes. It really wasn't any different than the stuff they had put out before. It just looked better because they were using those design languages that people had come to associate with like organic products and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's manipulative, right? But that's sort of fun.
That's what our job is. I mean, it's
that's what our job is.
I mean, a huge part of our job is psychology, if you think about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when we start new projects in my class, I make them go through a whole, you know, don't just tell me about the product. Tell me about who you're going after. Who are we designing this for? Right. Write up their story and what are the other brands they use and what are the things they're into and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can't, it's really hard to design, especially package design, without a consumer.
Yeah, you've got to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I love that aspect of it. There's lots I don't like about it, like, you know, doing 9 SKUs, sure. Where one flavor is BBQ and one flavor is like spicy Thai lagoon. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, how am I supposed to design all these different SKUs and the flavors have such drastically different amounts of letters? Like it's like, fuck. Like it's so hard.
Well, that's what you have junior designers for.
Yeah. No, and we do. I do that. But sometimes that design hurdle is, it can be really tough and sort of to figure out, you know, a lot of times I'll design for the biggest word, the biggest name first, you know, like if you're laying out a menu, if you're laying out a program for like a theater or something like that.
Yeah. That's what I do too.
Yeah. Find out who's got the longest name. Make sure that fits first. And then, you know, for without a doubt that all the rest of the names are going to fit in there. And that's a big deal. I really do enjoy package design. I love the 3D nature of it. You know what I mean? Like just seeing something. I still love printed material. That's one of the reasons I love web and app design. People call it product design. You know,
that like bothers me so much. I'm like, no, product is a physical thing.
Yeah. I was like, get out of here with this crap. You know? I'm not interested. I have people ask me questions about, what do you think about UX versus UI? And I'm like,
I don't care.
I try not to think about it.
Yeah.
To be honest,
you like, can't have one without the other.
It's, you know, does it work or does it not work? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
So the UX UI of package design is actually a thing you can hold in your hands, right? Do people understand what this product is? Do people know how to open it? Does this actually work? Does the product, when you pick it up, fall out of the bottom? Like, did you just like, it's like the basic stuff, you know, like will this hold the thing that I need it to hold?
Yep.
I like all that bullshit.
Yeah. No, I do too. That's the fun part. I like the tangible parts of design. I like that tactile feel. And that's like where you're talking about doing a spot varnish or a matte varnish. Yeah. You know, that can really make or break or elevate something. And you've got to find a way to make something stand out on the shelf when it's surrounded by 500 other things that are using the same sort of design language. And that's the fun part of it.
Oh man, you're absolutely right. Yeah. How can you come up with something unique and novel, but still communicates that design language, right? And there's a lot of really, really great design in package design that's fantastic. And I think does a really good job of that.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was on your site or if it was on Instagram, but you guys were doing some packaging for like some nut butters recently.
Yeah.
Those were really cool how you did those.
Oh, thanks a lot. We're doing a ton of different SKUs for that brand and another brand of theirs, which is really, that's been a really fun design challenge and really cool. I think that's an interesting point. If you look at the design of that thing, so that took us a long time to sort of figure out what that design should be because the client they're having a hard time communicating what they want. Right.
Sure.
So that ends up being us creating a lot of different looks for them until we find the right one. Mm-hmm. And so that one was, you know, a lot of the design stuff, it's sort of Victorian. It's almost like you would almost see like an, like a whiskey, like a whiskey label or something like that.
It's got the filigree and all that stuff.
Yeah, the filigree. It's got the it's all the detail, the line work and all that stuff. But I also try to put a contemporary twist on it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, we got that vintage typeface that says Raw Neo on it. But I'm trying not to be it. I try to use those design cliches, right, that communicate a certain level of fanciness, you know, but then also add in unique and interesting elements that make it ownable.
Yes.
Right. That also make it look like it's a new product and not just something you found at the thrift store. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I love that sort of, you know, how do I communicate this? How do I make it unique? But it still feels like it's supposed to feel.
Yeah. I'm trying not to laugh at the thought of food found at the thrift store.
Well, I mean, like package design found at the thrift store.
That's called TJ Maxx. TJ Maxx has the food at the thrift store kind of
feel.
You're right.
But I actually love, I love collecting old vintage tins.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those are full of fantastic design. There's a lot of good Instagram accounts that just sort of show old vintage packaging.
Yeah. I've become a digital hoarder of old cigar boxes. I used to for a while try to find them, but they're so hard to find where they're in any sort of good condition that I just digitally hoard them on Pinterest now.
I've found that two things, that vintage tins on eBay are relatively cheap. Mm-hmm. So it's a very cheap hobby. And that when you have something in your hand, you can look at it and turn it around, it's so much cooler than a JPEG.
Oh, yeah. It's much more rewarding.
Yeah, it is. But, so I find a lot of inspiration there. I think, you know, a lot of people go to Pinterest or whatever, Instagram or Dribbble to look for inspiration. eBay and Etsy are fantastic places because people that are putting stuff up there are just collectors of crap. It's
my mother-in-law.
Design blog or something like that.
That's my mother-in-law who goes to yard sales every week before we shut down yard sales.
And
would just buy stuff because it looked old.
Yeah. Yeah. I really do like, you know, I've been teaching package design for 8 years now, and it's actually given me a better appreciation of package design, trying to teach it and help me understand it in my own brain as well. I really do. I do like it.
Well, I think teaching something helps you learn something.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Or just having to speak it out loud.
Yeah.
Years ago, we've done a lot of work for Adobe. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I had a phone call with Adobe, my first phone call with Adobe to do some type tutorial stuff for them. And I had never, ever spoken the word Bezier out loud to anybody in my life. Uh-huh. Right. I had never heard it spoken. I've only ever read it. Right. And so I'm on the phone with Adobe and I pronounce it Bezier. and they started laughing at me. I'm like, oh my God. This is why design is better discussed and spoken and not just thought about in your head.
Yeah. Because if you don't realize it's supposed to be a French word.
No, I mean, I look back on it and I was like, oh yeah, obviously it's a fucking French word.
That's fine. I've butchered plenty of things that I should have known how to say. So, yeah,
but there's also like design concepts that you have in your head that you sort of have a grasp on, but if you never have to forcibly say them out loud in front of somebody, they don't become solid matter. You know what I mean?
This is very true. I got a couple quick questions before we wrap up touch on. And I literally just found out about these. I saw on Twitter probably a couple of weeks ago, you put up a list of a bunch of sports designers.
Mm, yeah.
Where they were paired up in twos, and there were a bunch of people that I know and I'm friends with. So yeah. I'm curious what that is. If you're talk about that.
That's actually the website I'm working on.
Oh, okay.
Right now. It's called Super Design Bowl.
Uh-huh.
Super Design Bowl is a stolen idea that I stole from there was this website called Type Fight.
Oh, I know Type Fight. I butchered a K.
Yeah. I did a D. For Type Fight.
I deservedly got my ass kicked.
Yeah. But they haven't been around for, I mean,
it's been about 3 or 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. They've been gone about 3 or 4 years. Right. But I was like, gosh, that was such a great site.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the sort of portfolio of all the images,
mm-hmm.
it's an immediate like B12 shot to your creativity.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Because you can just see all the different ways of executing something. Right. And color choices and palettes and lines and textures. It's amazing, right? And I loved it. And I was like, why? What if I took that? What if I stole that idea blatantly and then, but did it with sports branding, right? Because in the sports branding world, it's a little insular, right? I went to this sports branding, conference a couple of years ago called,
Major League Connect.
Major League. Right.
Yeah.
Connect. Major League Connect. And it's this whole part of design world.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to sort of work my way into it a little bit. And when a new design comes out for a team, everyone, it's a kind of a toxic environment. They talk crap about it. Everybody talks crap about it. It's like nobody did it, but then everyone does their own take on the logo for fun. And I was like, man, why don't I just take the competitive aspect of sports and the fact that everyone's doing their own logos for anything already, and then take the Type Fight idea and just have match designers up with each other and have them both like redo the Bulls logo and then let people vote and see who wins for fun, just for bragging rights. Right. And so we're calling it Super Design Bowl, which is a stupid name. But it's supposed to be like kind of like stupid. Yeah. But it's just like,
yeah,
hopefully the Super Bowl won't like,
I think you're pretty safe.
And we'll see. And so, so we're going to just do that. So that list of designers was just, those are the people we have signed up so far. So they're supposedly working on their logos now. And, once we get those, we'll launch with a bunch of designs ready to go, so we don't have like a big wall, and hopefully we'll release like one competition a week.
Oh, that's cool.
Let people vote on it. Yeah,
that's cool.
And then I'll have an application form on the website, so if you want to do one, you just say, hey, my name's Steve, here's my website, here's the teams I want to do, and then I can try to find you an appropriate opponent.
That is one of the design realms that I stay away from, because I love to look at sports logos, but I'm such not a sports guy.
Yeah.
That, like, I know that if I try to get into it, I I've got no reference point for myself to bounce off of.
Now, see, that's interesting, because I've purposefully got some designers that do not do sports branding.
Okay.
People from outside the sports branding world, because I'm like, okay, let's see if I can, you know, pie in the sky, interject some new graphical ideas and aesthetics into the sports branding world, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is really insular, and it's really, you know, it's a snake eating its own tail.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It's very much creative. It's very much its own design realm.
Yeah. So what if I get these guys from outside, and then they come in and they can sort of rewrite the book a little bit, you know, or at least inject a little bit of their DNA into some sport branding ideas. So when somebody Googles Rams logo,
yeah,
maybe this thing will come up and it'll influence people in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll talk in a year and see if I'm still doing the site. I don't know. But, so far it's been fun. I'm redoing a Panthers logo right now for
it.
Yeah. And so
yeah, because their logo is not all that great.
It's one of my least favorite ones.
It's actually my least favorite dated. NFL.
I feel like there's some real bad flattening out and parts of the face, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like it's, now I'm not saying all logos need to be dimensional, but like there's parts of it that are trying to be dimensional and then it like flattens out and looks mushy and squished and like it needs a little more detail consideration in it. So that one bothers me. So we redid that one.
Yeah. It's hard to get much detail when you've got just a solid black with a couple highlights of blue.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fine to do a sort of like I was saying, a 2D logo, flat, you know, mark, but just decide which way you're going to go. You know, I've been doing this other thing where it's called the trademark tees.
That's the other one I was going to ask you about.
That's a threadless shop.
Yeah.
That's been a lot of fun.
I stumbled on it a few days ago and didn't realize it was you until I was listening to the podcast you did with Dave Clayton earlier today. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So I started this threadless shop as just sort of my thing to do while my wife yells at me for not doing the dishes. and that is, I collected all these old books of logo designs, right? And I'm blatantly stealing them. These logos that would have been long forgotten, logos that are not for companies that don't exist anymore. A lot of times for companies that the trademark is long since forgotten about. And I'm just, I love them. I love the way they look. And I thought to myself, man, that would be really cool on a t-shirt. So I was like, well, why don't I just scan a bunch of them in and then make them available for everybody to put on a t-shirt. But by doing that, it's actually really helped and informed my ideas about what makes a good logo.
Oh yeah.
Like what makes a good logo mark. And I didn't even really think about that aspect of it, but like going through these books and scanning in hundreds of images, I've got right now, we've got about 300 logos trademark tees. And I have a stack of books behind me that, so I'm guessing if I just estimated maybe 1500 more that I could potentially put on this thing. And so if you go into, I just started, my friend's like, dude, there's too many, there's already 300 on there. It's impossible to find what you might be looking for. It's like, oh, you're right. So if you go on there, you can click on collections and I'm trying to categorize them now.
Gotcha. That's probably a smart idea.
Yeah. So, but that's actually been a lot of fun. That's very much a digging the ditch graphic design project because scanning, thresholding, sizing, loading, you know, like it's like, oh God, what
praying that Image Trace will actually hold up on it.
No, I don't Image Trace any of them. It's all
okay.
I don't fix them for the most part unless there's like a big error. I don't clean them up. I don't redraw them.
Oh, really?
I don't image trace them. So, like, if it's a shitty scan, like a shitty printing job on it, it's a little rough. I want to sort of preserve that. So, they're a little fucked up,
cool.
Right? Because I like
that aesthetic. Character.
Yes, I like. Yeah, I like that aesthetic. I like the character of it. So, yeah. It's also faster if I do it that way.
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. So I've got
probably helps the marriage out a little bit to do it the faster way there.
Yeah. But yeah. So that's all my hobbies that I told you about. I used to play in a band. I used to play soccer, but not anymore. Now I just scan pictures in.
Yeah. Hard to be in a band and play soccer in your 40s. Gets harder the older you get.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. It became hard when we had a kid.
Yeah. Well, then it gets really hard.
Then it became really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. The responsibility definitely kicks in once you have a kid.
Goddamn responsibility.
I know. Boy. I love my kids. I would not trade them in for the world, but a vacation every once in a while.
That's for rich people. Not for us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I want to wrap up with a couple or a few quick fire questions since it's feasting on design. These are rapid fire about food. It's usually the first thing that comes to your mind.
Oh, no.
So it's easy. It's just three questions. First one is, what's kind of your earliest food memory?
Oh, my earliest food memory.
It doesn't have to be good. It can be horrible, too.
I don't know what my earliest food memory is. I never thought about it. The food growing up was not good. See, so I didn't think about it much.
I mean, that's mine. My earliest. So my family's Danish. And my mom would make this Danish dish called frikadella, which is just basically the Danish version of Swedish meatballs.
Okay.
But as a kid, I couldn't stand it because it was, you know, you throw the meatballs in, you make this brown gravy, and you throw the potatoes and the carrots and all that stuff in the same, basically, crock pot and let it cook all day. So everything just had the same consistency. It was brown, mush, and tasted like gravy. And I, to this day, I cannot stand it.
Really?
And I didn't think about it until the other day. I was watching, there's a show on Netflix called Somebody Feed Phil.
I love that show. It's a good show.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome. And we were watching the Copenhagen episode, and they were talking about frikadella, and they made it, and it looked absolutely delicious. I was like, well, maybe I need to revisit that.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I'm a pretty good cook. Maybe I need to find my mom's recipe and tweak it a little bit to see if I can't find something that I like. So,
yeah, I used to hate, like, steak growing up.
Really?
Because...
Oh, it was cooked till it was dry?
Oh, my. It was shoe leather.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Like, my mom burns the crap out of everything, right? Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's a product of the baby boomer era. Like, everything is overcooked.
Yeah, I think it may be because their parents grew up in the Great Depression and, like, food wasn't safe, so they had to cook the hell out of it.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what it is.
I don't know.
That's the same thing. So, what's your go-to comfort food? Like, if you've just had
donuts?
See, that was easy right away. Why donuts?
Well, listen, if you ask me what my favorite food is, it's donuts.
Why donuts, but why donuts?
Well, my mom was a baker growing up.
Oh.
And couldn't cook meat on Sundays. No. A baker.
Yes.
So when she on Sundays, she come home from work and usually would have donuts.
Awesome.
Love donuts. Still love donuts. Don't eat them as much as I should. No. Put that the other way around. Eat them more often than I should, but not as much as I want to.
There you go.
Yeah.
You have a favorite donut place?
You know, I work right down the street from the fancy donut shop. What's it called? A fancy donut place. That place is good. Sorry.
No.
But in St. Louis, Missouri, they have a grocery store called Schnucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they have – what they do is – I've only found these in the St. Louis area.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had them at her grocery store where she was a baker. So they get the, like, Danish stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like that you would put a cheese
The
cherry
kind of,
Danish that thing, film, right? It's more of a flaky kind of a deal. Instead of doing that with it, deep fry it like a donut and then glaze it like a donut.
Oh, yeah, that sounds really good.
That was amazing.
That
was my go-to.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. What is your death row meal, the last thing you can ever eat?
Well, I mean, I love donuts, right?
Sure.
So I won't say that again. But there's a fancy French bakery in Chicago, La Boulangerie or something. And they have a Danish that is a cheese blueberry Danish.
Oh.
It's so good. I would eat the, they sell them at La Colombe coffee shop right by my work. And that's probably, I don't really miss my employees or my coworkers. I miss the cheese blueberry Danish that I would get at the coffee shop. Oh my God. So good.
Yeah.
So good. One time they gave me two.
Oh, nice.
Because they're cool and they would give me free coffee and stuff because I don't know. Cause I look like I need helpers, I guess. And I loved it. But I work with, you know, five other people. So I was like, well, I can't, who am I going to give the extra?
I can't pick a favorite. That's not fair.
I can't pick a favorite. So I had to eat the second one myself too.
I'm sure you were heartbroken over that.
I couldn't, I mean, what was I going to do? I couldn't, I was going to make someone feel bad. So I just had to eat both of them. You know,
and you made yourself feel good.
Yeah.
And hate yourself at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely a sweets guy, not so much a savory guy.
I'm a sweets guy when it comes to breakfast, but the rest of the time, yeah. I'm more of a salty snack kind of person.
Yeah, I like salty things just like everybody else, but sweets.
I mean, you can see me. I'm pretty equal opportunity here.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Billy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Where can people find you online?
So go to deliciousdesignleague.com, Delicious Design League on Instagram, Delicious DL on Twitter. You can follow me at Athletic Design Club. That's where we're going to be putting the Super Design Bowl. You can follow me on Trademark Tees on Instagram. I got too many accounts.
We'll link to all of them. Don't worry. I'll put it in the show notes.
It's really annoying. Yeah. Trademark Tees on Threadless, the Athletic Design Club, Delicious Design League. Those are almost all the things that I've got out there.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks. This was a great talk.
Yeah. And go out and break some bread.
Listen, I'm hungry. I'm going to go get some donuts right now.
Special thanks to Roasters Marketplace for sponsoring this episode of Feasting on Design. Be sure to visit them and pick up some delicious coffee from one of their 29 micro roasters. You can find them at roastersmarketplace.com or on social media. Use the code FEAST for free shipping on your first order. You can find out more about Billy on Twitter at DeliciousDL and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. I hope you like this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think. And if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram, or over at my website, ildisdesign.com.